WFYI podcast brought to you by Bloomington, Indiana, an American college town offering food and drink, college sports, outdoor activities, live music, cool art, and good times daily. Everyone is welcome in Bloomington. More information at visitbloomington.com.
We're going to take a trip right now. Like we always do about this time.
This is a journey into sound.
Down. You're tuned in to 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Kyle Long from Nouveau News Weekly, and this is Cultural Manifesto. Tonight's edition of Cultural Manifesto is all about the Lotus World Music and Arts Festival, happening September 15th to the 18th in Bloomington, Indiana. This year's Lotus Fest lineup features dozens of incredible musicians from around the world, including groups from Argentina, Zimbabwe, Sweden, Iceland, Colombia, the Canary Islands, Ethiopia, India, Mongolia, and so much more. And on tonight's show, we'll be featuring music and conversation from three of the artists performing on this year's Lotus Fest lineup. Up first, I'll be speaking with Tahir Haim of the Israeli Yemenite group AWA. After that, we'll be joined by Johnny Calci of the Dole Foundation, an influential and innovative UK group famous for their blend of electronic music and Punjabi Bhangra. And finally, we'll be joined by Sudanese singer El Sara. I want to kick off tonight's show with a track from AWA. This is their massive international hit, Habib Galbi. I'm Kyle Long. You're tuned in to Cultural Manifesto, made possible in part by the Indianapolis Foundation, celebrating 100 years of service. I'm Kyle Long. You're tuned in to Cultural Manifesto on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Tonight's show is all about the Lotus World Music and Arts Festival, happening September 15th to the 18th in Bloomington, Indiana. You can go to lotusfest.org for more information. We just heard the track Habib Galbi by Awa, who found international fame mixing the traditional songs of their Yemenite heritage with contemporary sounds of hip-hop, reggae, and R&B. Awa will be performing at this year's Lotus Fest, and we're joined via telephone by Awa member Tahir Haim, who's speaking to us from her home in Tel Aviv. Tahir, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you. My pleasure.
I wanted to ask you a few questions, obviously, about the group and your musical influences and your upcoming tour here in the U.S. I read an interview with you, and you mentioned that when you were young, you were very influenced by your parents' record collection, and you were listening to, you know, psychedelic British rock like Pink Floyd. Can you talk a little bit about the music you were listening to growing up that kind of formed what you're doing today?
So we grew up in a very small desert village in southern Israel. It's called Shacharut. And it felt like music chose us. I mean, we just loved to sing and to perform and to dance. And so we used to listen to music a lot. We stole our parents' record collection, and there was I remember like a record of Bob Marley. We found some records like you said, psychedelic music from the 60s and the 70s. I think there was like Pink Floyd, Deep Purple, if I'm not mistaken, Fleetwood Mac. And then we grew up surrounded by Native American speakers, because around this village there were people that made Aliyah from the States and from the UK. So we used to hear at school and in the local youth center, we used to hear a lot of jazz and American musicals, and we fell in love with this too. And we discovered the vocal harmonies. And at a very young age, we used to sing, the three of us, in harmonies. I would take the lead voice. And then Tagel, she's the curly one. She would take the high voice and Liron the low one. And we had this kind of a formula of singing together. And I remember when we used to go to our grandparents. So we used to hear a lot of Yemenite music and we were surrounded by the Yemenite community. So we fell in love with Yemenite music, with this awesome groove. I remember like hearing the sound of women drumming on a tin drum and singing with a soulful voice, very tribal singing. It was like fascinating for me, for like a young girl with musical ears. So I said, like, we had these influences of, with harmonies, like jazz, great vocalists, and also Motown, the Jackson 5, and the Yemenite music, and then the psychedelic music from 60s and 70s. And then in our teens, MTV came, and I think it was like 90s. We fell in love with hip-hop. So we have many influences. But the Yemenite music was like maybe the biggest influenced. 5 years ago when we started making music again together, thinking about taking this thing to the next level and forming this band officially, we just saw that naturally we are combining the Yemenite music as the main influence, and we mix it with other styles like reggae and hip-hop. We were blown away by the results. We recorded some demos and we uploaded some videos to YouTube back then, and we started receiving many beautiful comments. That's how we knew we should look for a producer and work on our debut album.
In that video now, Habib Galbi has over, I think, 5 million views now. Did it surprise you how quickly people embraced this kind of new sound you had developed?
Yeah, because we didn't know how people will react to this music and visuals. We shot the video near Shacharut, our village, and that's how we thought we should begin our story. We can't take it for granted. I mean, it's overwhelming to receive all these beautiful things that people say and how it makes people happy in Arab countries, and then you hear from hipsters and even people in the States. And we hoped that the song will be catchy and will make people feel something, but it's beyond our expectations. It's even better.
I'm Kyle Long. You're listening to Cultural Manifesto on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. If you're just tuning in tonight, my guest is Tahir Haim of the Israeli-Yemenite vocal trio, AWA. Let's pause for a minute and listen to another track off AWA's debut LP, Habib Galbi. You're tuned in to Cultural Manifesto on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. We just heard a track from AWA, one of the many groups who will be performing at this year's Lotus World Music and Arts Festival. That's happening September 15th through the 18th in Bloomington, Indiana. You can go to lotusfest.org for tickets and more information. Let's rejoin our conversation with Tahir Haim of AWA.
You mentioned the influence of hip-hop music on your work. It's sort of interesting because Yemenite music has played an important role in the development of sample culture in hip-hop music. As I'm sure you know, in 1987, the group Cold Cut sampled Ofra Heza for the remix of Eric B. and Rakim, Paid in Full.
When all is ready, I throw this switch.
Pump up the volume, pump up the volume.
Pump that bass.
That was my first exposure to Yemenite music, and I'm sure it was for many other Americans and Europeans. Was that record an influence for you? And AWA, can you talk about that merging of hip-hop and Yemenite music?
Yes, I mean, we used to know Ofra Heza. I mean, we grew up listening to her music, and when this Yemenite album of hers came out, we were blown away by it. And, like, she's the... We know other Yemenite great singers, but she's like the most famous singer that brought this music to the world. When we saw this blend that people are starting to mix her songs and to remix her songs and to blend it with hip hop, we felt like wow, it's something that is very inspirational, and we can also do something of our own. Like, as a younger generation, of course, it's a great influence.
And I'm curious, do you know how your music is being received in Yemen, this fusion that you've created on the album?
Wow, in Yemen, it's so funny because we can't go there. We can't perform there. It's too dangerous even for people from Yemen to be in Yemen right now. But we hear all the time that people are blown away by our music, like families love to listen to this, and young students that left Yemen and now live in Europe, they come to our shows. They say that little girls look at the video of Habib Galbi and they look at us as role models, and it's heartwarming because thanks to this social media, we can be exposed to places that we can't even go. So it's a beautiful thing, and we see it as a great gift. And it's a fantasy to perform in Yemen, but thank God that people can enjoy it and find comfort. We get a lot of beautiful comments from people say that thank you for your great music, for putting our culture in the front stage, making us feel happy and find comfort in these hard times.
And I want to understand this correctly. It's my understanding that the songs on Habib Galbi are built around traditional folk songs. Is that correct?
Yes, it's correct. It's like an oral tradition that were passed down from one woman to another. It's like a folklore that women created in Yemen. The Jewish women in Yemen, they didn't know how to read and write, and they couldn't participate in the synagogue services of men. So their music wasn't religious, but secular folk songs that they found as an outlet for their emotions, because they couldn't express themselves freely around men. So everything they wanted to say, very daring and I don't know, sometimes hard things or cheesy things, and so they just expressed it in through these songs. So we used to hear these songs from our grandma. We just took it to our own place, gave it our own twist, added the vocal harmonies, which is totally a Western element, also the production, the electronic beats, and we tell the stories from our perspective. It's really cool to play with that.
Thank you so much for speaking with me today, Tahir. I absolutely love the work you're making. It's so fantastic, and I really am excited that you guys are going to be performing here in Indiana.
Yes, hope to see you in person.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much, Tahir.
I'm Kyle Long. You're tuned in to Cultural Manifesto on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Tonight's show is all about the Lotus World Music and Arts Festival, happening September 15th to the 18th in Bloomington, Indiana. Up next, I'll be welcoming another artist performing on this year's Lotus Fest lineup. Johnny Calci is a master of the dole. The dole is a large drum that provides the heartbeat for the North Indian folk music known as Bhangra. Johnny Calci was born and raised in the United Kingdom, and that's where he formed the Dole Foundation, a group famous for its blend of electronic music and traditional Indian folk styles. In addition to forming the Dole Foundation, Johnny Calci has been a part of groups like Transglobal Underground, Afro-Celt Sound System, and the influential UK Bhangra band Alap. Johnny has appeared as a guest musician on albums by artists like Peter Gabriel. His work has been featured on the soundtracks of films like Gangs of New York and Last Temptation of Christ. And he's toured alongside artists including Robert Plant and Jimmy Page. And Johnny Calci joins us tonight via telephone from his home in London. Johnny, I know you've worked with so many incredible groups, and I want to focus our conversation on your work with Dole Foundation since you're going to be performing here in the U.S., but I'm a huge Bhangra fan, and I wanted to ask about your work in the early UK Bhangra scene. You were part of the group Alap, which is a very important and influential group in that scene. Can you just talk a little bit about your work kind of coming up as a musician during that time and performing with Alap?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, back in the day, we're going back, late 80s, the Bhangra band Alap never really had a door player, and it was kind of like an accidental audition, really, where the band took a break halfway and then I came on with the DJ, and then they asked me to kind of turn up at a studio where they were recording, which I did, and they offered me some live gigs from that point on. I never looked back, 1986 or something. It's quite ridiculous, really.
That style of Bhangra went on to kind of conquer the world, and Punjabi MC had this huge hit with Jay-Z. When you started out with Alap, did you see a point where this music would kind of reach this mass exposure?
No, I was still a bit young then, and we were kind of still growing with the phenomena and the whole Bhangra movement of around about that time and that era. And when I mean the Bhangra movement, back then everybody was really wanting, you know, a live Bhangra band at their wedding or party or function or whatever it was that they were doing, as well as all the gigs that was going on at that time. But no, I didn't envisage that to be such a massive wave, a massive phenomena. But there was, I mean, looking back on it, back then, being second generation British Asian, our parents, they came over from Kenya, and my whole family, they were all born in Kenya, and I was born in the UK. But growing up, we, you know, obviously we went to British schools, and back then it was still a little bit sort of taboo to play your own music in public, because people just didn't appreciate what we were about and our culture. Well, they didn't know enough about it, to be honest. So growing up, you know, there was lots of mixed feelings in amongst the community, even at schools. I was probably one of five kids in my year that were Indian, you know, or Indian descent. Everybody else was sort of, you know, typically English and white. But we had, you know, a mixture of friends, and we got on. We would listen to, you know, whatever was current in the charts, which would probably be, I don't know, Led Zeppelin, Duran Duran, people like that, Adamant and Boy George. And then at home, we were listening to traditional stuff. You know, every Sunday there'd be an Asian program, the only Asian program that came on an obscure channel, and from about 6 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday. So all the Asian people would wake up at that time. It was sort of halfway through the birth of that, the birth of that program, that VHS was invented, and then, you know, the quite well-off Asian people, they all went out and purchased VHS recorders, and they would set their timers and record the program every Sunday, you know. But it was quite interesting to see all that wave take place. And what I did understand from all of that, there was like maybe three or four guys from my generation that took almost the same path. So we would listen to Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan on that Sunday morning Asian program, Noor Jahan and people like that, because those kind of people were very influential to the Asian media, and their songs and their ghazals and their qawwalis actually were quite meaningful. But because it had that Punjabi tilt to it, you know, all the Punjabis that we knew, my uncles, aunts, everybody, they all watched it. So, of course, we would get up and we'd watch it as well with parents. And the interesting thing about all of that, there was myself, there was Bobby Friction, there was Nitin Sawhney, Talvin Singh. All of us kind of have the same background where our parents came from abroad, they settled, and we were listening to a mixture of musics. So for our ears and for the way we actually perceive and hear music, it was very natural for us to fuse it. So being in a LARP and having that style, that unique style, rather than play an Indian groove on the drum kit, we played a Western groove. And that, to our ears, was much more natural to do it that way. So, of course, you know, I took the Bangla route because of my LARP background. Nitin Sawhney, he kind of took he was playing guitar, and he took the classical route. There was Talvin Singh, who took the Asian underground route and mixed Indian sitar and Wailee vocals, beautiful female Wailee vocals over drum and bass loops, and added his tabla on top, which was quite mesmerizing, quite amazing. And of course there was Bobby Friction, who came from a radical punk background, and he would sort of mix his influence beats and his DJ grooves over the top of, you know, traditional Indian, and just kind of mix it all up, really. Yeah, I was the only one that took the Bhangra influence, and because the Dhol in itself, the DNA of that instrument is Bhangra, ultimately. You know, you can't get away from it. We do portray it, but, you know, we like to be as diverse as possible and show the full potential of this amazing instrument.
And you mentioned coming up in the same era as Talvin Singh and Nitin Sawhney. You know, the Dhol Foundation is obviously famous for blending the electronic sound with Dhol and with the Bhangra influence. Were you guys all kind of developing these ideas simultaneously, apart from one another, of mixing the South Asian music with electronics? Or was this something you kind of were aware of what everyone else was doing and you were influencing each other? Because for us in the U.S., in 1997, when Anoka came out, Talvin Singh's compilation, Sounds of the Asian Underground, that was our first exposure to the music. So it just seemed like it came out of nowhere, and that Talvin Singh was the kind of mastermind of this sound.
What was happening? That was around a lot before that. It wasn't new to our ears, because, you know, before Anoka, he was doing it, you know, long before then. I mean, he played on a LARP's double album. And a lot of people don't really know that, because Talvin doesn't really mention it. But, you know, he toured with a LARP back in 1990. He toured with us when we went to Pakistan. It was kind of simultaneous. And there was a kind of an awareness of everybody else doing doing their stuff. And of course, yeah, even in the UK, the Anoka thing was, it was a big movement, it was a big wave. And I'm still friends with his PR company that actually put that out. The interesting thing was that the most famous track on that album was nicked from A.R. Rahman's film Bombay. And he stuck it on his album, which is fine. He credited them, but I think he got himself in a little bit of problems, but I think they sorted it out all internally in the end. Yeah, no, we liked what each other did, and, you know, when our paths crossed, we always, you know, meet each other, acknowledge and shake hands, give each other a hug and find out what the next thing is in the pipeline, whatever they're working on. But, you know, we're not enemies. We all understand that we've grown up together. We know where everybody comes from. Our paths don't cross that much, but when they do, then it's an embrace. You know, it's nice.
I'm Kyle Long. You're listening to Cultural Manifesto on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. If you're just tuning in, my guest is Johnny Kalsi of Dole Foundation. Let's pause for a minute and listen to a classic track by the Dole Foundation. This is Colors of Punjab. I'm Kyle Long. You're tuned in to Cultural Manifesto on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. We just heard Colors of Punjab by the Dole Foundation, one of many groups performing at this year's Lotus World Music and Arts Festival, happening September 15th to the 18th in Bloomington, Indiana. You can go to lotusfest.org to see the full artist lineup or to purchase tickets. Let's return to our conversation with Dole Foundation founder Johnny Kalsi.
What was the reaction when you first started mixing these kind of contemporary electronics with the traditional instruments in the UK?
The electronica that came out of merely experimental, nothing else, just proper, really sort of going into it and experimenting. And I remember just being in a studio working with a guy called TJ Remy, and he was on his Atari 1080 screaming about having like one meg of sampling power, which everyone thought back then was like is equivalent to having a terabyte. But so yeah, TJ Remy, and he was slowing down hip-hop beats, so he would slow them right down to do the programming, and then he would speed them up to ridiculous, which I kind of thought was outrageous. So he'd program it like 60 BPM and then speed it up to like 180 to make sort of drum and bass loops. And I'd be like, this is amazing. This is fascinating. It didn't sound right to my ears, but when it all came out and when it started sort of attacking the Asian underground scene, everyone was loving it, really loving it. And they loved it to a point, the artist General Levy, who'd done a track called Wicked Wicked, and he even turned up at Bangra gigs to do his thing. So he was being booked by Bangra promoters, which is quite amazing, really. So that influence, that whole electronica was purely, it started at experimental, but it just grew. And the influence just spread like wildfire, which was great and completely natural for us to do that.
And when you heard TJ Remy, these experiments he was doing, did you immediately hear a place for the Dole in that rhythm? Did you immediately see a place for your contribution to this music?
Yeah, completely. I mean, there was a track that Remy did with myself. It was called Who Killed Bhangra? And that track, it was one of our showcase tracks that we would present on stage. That was before we even had an album. It was quite funny.
You know, the Dole is such a powerful instrument. When there's a Dole player hitting the drum, it commands everyone's attention. And when I see a Dole player, I want to learn how to play. I feel very inspired. I'm curious if you remember when you first had that feeling that you wanted to learn this instrument.
My dad, he had like 17 cousin sisters. They're all round about the same age, obviously from different parents, round about within 5 years, and they all had to get married. So, you know, across that time, we were dragged along to wedding after wedding, you know, and it was quite amazing. And, you know, for me, being sort of between the age of 7 to 11, it was kind of a real eye-opener. And I had one particular uncle who kept a Dole drum under, you know, under wraps, and he'd only pull it out when there was a wedding. That sort of became the highlight of me going to a wedding, because otherwise it was boring for us, you know, 7-year-old just going to a wedding, not much to do, and you roll up, you know, you get all the lads together and roll up everyone's socks and use it as a football, you know, just kind of kick it around the place and annoy the rest of the family. But, you know, this came along and it was an absolute eye-opener, and I was, like, mesmerized. So I guess that first sort of influence was there from that moment, you know, from my uncle. No, I never really expected that I would end up picking up this instrument and it being the love of my life. It is a very powerful instrument, you're absolutely right. And I think that it was the power that actually drew me to that. And it was the fact that, you know, when you hear that drum, the first instant reaction that people get is just that overwhelming feeling. And I do remember having that myself and going, you know what, I want to do that.
I'm Kyle Long. You're listening to Cultural Manifesto on 90.1 WFYI. If you're just tuning in, my guest is Johnny Calcee of the British Bhangra group, The Dole Foundation. Let's pause for a minute and listen to another track from The Dole Foundation. I'm Kyle Long. You're listening to Cultural Manifesto on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Tonight's show is all about the Lotus World Music and Arts Festival, happening September 15th through the 18th in Bloomington, Indiana. You can go to lotusfest.org for more information or to purchase tickets. Let's return to our conversation with Dole Foundation founder Johnny Calcee. And Johnny, you've taken Bhangra music in so many different interesting directions through your work with Dole Foundation. Are you still coming up with new concepts and new places you want to take this music?
Absolutely, yeah, totally. I want to expose my drum to Jay-Z and Beyonce. I want them to hear the power of it, and I want to hear them, you know, the potential. I want Eminem to do a rap over one of my beats. I don't even care if it's not a number one hit. I just want to expose it to the artists that have already made the jump and already got there, however they did it. You know, the track that I did with Avril Lavigne, she chose, it was an interesting one. It was for MTV's War Child that I think got released in Russia. I can't remember. And she chose the track Knocking on Heaven's Door by Bob Dylan. And she wanted to put an Asian flavor on it. There's nothing I could do with the Dole because it's such a slow track. And it was just her and her guitar. And I just thought, what am I going to do? And we chatted for a bit, and then I just put some double R down, put a bit of Tanpura as a drone in the background, and just kind of made an Asian version of it, which was quite nice. And I think it got played in sort of like, you know, Viva channel, which is like MTV in India, stuff like that. Nelly Furtado, that was another one. And then the interesting one that I exposed, the interesting band that I exposed my drum to was Led Zeppelin. Mm. That was back in 1997, which was really cool because I got to tour with them for 6 weeks. And it was just, it was a time of my life to watch a real rock and roll tour and just see everything and help them out where they needed it and just come together and become positive friends with Robert, you know. But I think, you know, in all of this, the most important part of all of this is that the ability to still expose what we do to the masses, and to have that influence and the Bangra DNA in the drum, of course. It's just a barrel with two sides and two skins, sure. But the potential and the sound difference in each side and the potential that you can give rhythmically, I think there's so many artists out there that really need to hear this.
Johnny, thank you so much for taking time to speak with me today. It's been an honor. I've enjoyed and loved and been a fan of your work for many, many years, so I really appreciate the opportunity.
Oh, bless you. Thank you very much.
Speak. Yeah, thanks so much, and I look forward to seeing you in Bloomington. I'm Kyle Long. You're tuned in to Cultural Manifesto on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Tonight's show is all about the Lotus World Music and Arts Festival, happening September 15th to the 18th in Bloomington, Indiana. Up next, I'll be welcoming another artist performing on this year's Lotus Fest lineup. El Sara and the Nubatones are a Sudanese group that perform a style of music they've dubbed East African Retro Pop. I spoke with the group's founder, El Sara, via telephone. El Sara left the Sudan at age 12 when she immigrated to the United States with her family. I asked if she was able to keep up with Sudanese music as a teenager in the United States.
I was able to maintain my link with Sudan mostly the first 9 years I was in America through the music, actually, and my parents. Because while we were in our migration, you know, while we were getting our paperwork done and whatever, we couldn't leave the country for a while. So that was, I stayed in touch through my family mostly. And once the internet came about, it was also really helpful in that. The music, honestly, my love, it was always in the background. I listened to a lot of music from North Africa and East Africa, and different traditional musics in general as a teenager. But I rekindled my love for Sudanese music specifically once I got to college.
In 2013, El Sara released her debut LP, a collaboration with the French electronic music producer Debruy. I asked El Sara how this collaboration with Debruy came to be.
You know, I was always a fan of Debruy's music. He's a really brilliant composer, in my opinion, a producer, and I reached out to him, actually, just randomly through the internet when he had dropped something. I had just started my project with the Nubatones and we just only recorded one song. And I sent it to him at that point, and I was just like, you know, I'm really interested in working with you. I think you and I, you know, could do something really unique together about music, about Sudanese music especially. And in my head, I thought we would just maybe make, like, a song. I mean, if he even called me back. And so I was really happy that he actually reached out to me. It felt really serendipitous. I ended up on one of my tours, actually I was going on tour to Pakistan on the way back. I ended up meeting him in Brussels and we rented a house together and kind of banged out this project over 2 weeks. And then he worked on it for another year after I left and then it was put out. So it was one of those random moments. Hey!
asked El Sera about her 2015 LP Silt, her first with the Nubatones. Silt found El Sera moving away from the electronic sounds on her 2013 debut and returning to more traditional Sudanese instrumentation.
For me, was really important to make with the Nubatones, and it happened over the period of like a year and a half, almost 2 years. Interestingly enough, I started it around the same time as I started working on the Al Jawal project with Debruy, but it was happening simultaneously, but released a year later. Making Silk was just as important as making Al Jawal, because it was really important for me to establish the roots from which I come. And I've always thought, for me, I don't really see a difference between traditional music and pop or modern music. To me, they're all extensions of the same thing, and kind of like I think of that, of music in general, as a circle, with all these things as being different points within the circle. So working on Silk for me felt very natural. Like, it was for me about setting the foundation and the grounding from which I come musically, and all the things that I love about that sound, which for me were the rocking parts of it, as well as the traditional sounds in it. And the album was about, I would say, like 50% original compositions, 50% traditional songs with our own arrangements of it. So for me, it was just about making an album from which I can jumpstart making my own sound. But because I was working in a really local level, like we started this project in New York, I never really thought it would go beyond the New York boundaries when I made it.
I'm Kyle Long. You're tuned in to Cultural Manifesto on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. If you're just tuning in, my guest is the Sudanese singer El Sera, one of the many artists performing at this year's Lotus World Music Festival in Bloomington, Indiana. That's happening September 15th to the 18th, and you can go to lotusfest.org for more information. El Sera has a new album coming out this September, which blends the electronic elements found on her first LP with the more traditional sounds heard on Silt. I asked El Sera to explain her transition into this new sound.
For me, like I said before, like I made Silt so I could actually make Manara, so I can make this second album, which for me has been about the real blending of all the different sounds in my brain. I'm a global child. I've moved around my whole life, and my brain has all these sounds in it. These are all parts of my soundtrack. So to combine, I actually think of the synthesizer and keys that we added to it as also being really retro, because they're very retro style keyboard and synthesizer sounds that were provided by Yusuke Yamamoto, who's a Japanese keyboard player, actually.
Let's listen to Yawatan, the first single off El Sera and the Nubatones' upcoming album, Manara. El Sera, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much, Kyle, for the call, and thank you for all your questions.
When
That's all the time we have for tonight. Thank you for tuning in. You can catch Cultural Manifesto every Wednesday evening at 9 here on 90.1. And you can find over 4 years of columns I've written in the archives of Nuvo.net. I'm Kyle Long. You've been listening to Cultural Manifesto, made possible in part by the Indianapolis Foundation, celebrating 100 years of service. Thank you and good night.